Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 477. What Did They Do Next? Part 20b, Rick Wakeman once again.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 477 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in just a little bit. Please do get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I return to the centre of the Earth, which is what Rick Wakeman did after leaving Yes this time round. We were delighted to be able to talk to Nick Cacciapo, and you'll hear that interview in just a moment. He was instrumental in getting this record released at all. So, with plenty to talk about on that, let's go straight over to that interview now. It's wonderful to welcome Nick Cacciapo onto the Yes Music Podcast this week. And we've got some questions for him about his involvement with Rick Wakeman's return to the center of the Earth.
Hello, Nick. Nice to have you on.
Hello, Mark.
So the first question is, you have an amazing story about how you helped Rick Wakeman get this album made. But before we get to that, when did you first meet Rick and how?
It was 1989 backstage at a ABWH concert in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And how did you find yourself there?
Well, to be honest, the local radio station were supposed to have me get the backstage passes from the will call window, but they forgot to do it. And it was a radio station that I did business with. So I was very upset. So I waited after the concert, and two guys were leaving the concert. And I walked up to them and said, "How'd you like to sell your backstage passes?" So I did. I bought their passes from them. And that was the first night that I really met Rick in person.
Yeah.
And also the same night that I became friends with John Anderson.
Yeah. What was it like backstage in those days?
Cold. It was cold outdoor concert.
Right. Any craziness?
Well, not really. I was just excited to meet John and Rick. The first thing I did when I walked up to Rick was, "Would you sign my album for me, the Topographic Oceans album?" He said, "Certainly." Mm. So as he was signing it, I said to Rick, "You know, that's the greatest album you ever recorded on." And Rick said, "Oh, you don't say."
Excellent stuff. So did you keep in touch with them? Did you get to know them a lot better after that?
Oh, yeah. I talk to John probably once a month, and I talk to Rick whenever he's on tour or in between an email. And after we got to know each other first, I started to do things with Rick, like I'd have ideas for him. Actually, I'm not bragging, but I'm the person who got Rick to start doing solo piano concerts.
And those are really nice, aren't they, though? I'm hoping to get to one this next time that he goes around the UK. But let's get on to this album itself. After Rick left Yes, following Keys to Ascension and all that, he tried to get some solo projects off the ground. However, he was quite ill, wasn't he, and had other problems, is that right?
Yes, I was actually with him the day before he had fallen ill, and he was very out of breath. He was actually in Los Angeles, and he was recording Return to Center of the Earth is what he was doing. And when we were walking back to his car, he was very out of breath, and we both went back to the airport to go to our homes, and he actually was very, very sick by the time we got to the airport. He was sweating a lot.
Gosh.
And out of breath. He was just simply saying, "I'm so out of shape."
Yeah.
I got an email from Dan Wooding saying that Rick was in a coma. And I thought, that's crazy. I just saw him the day before.
Yeah, yeah.
So Dan Wooding kept me up. Bless his heart. He kept me up on the news of Rick's condition. And I was glad to see that he made it out. But
did he have a heart ailment or something, or what was wrong with him?
It was pleurisy, and I think he had some kind of pneumonia.
Gosh.
Oh.
And somehow or another, he went into a coma.
That's not good. So how and why did you get involved with Return to the Center of the Earth?
Well, I was actually traveling with Rick a lot in the 1990s. he would stay up very late at night in the hotel rooms and continue to compose what he said was going to be a sequel to Journey to the Center of the Earth. And then as time went on, I mean, I think he was working on Return to the Center for a few years. And I said, Rick, if you can get this done and you can get the people involved that you say you can get involved, I can help you get a recording contract for this. And he told me the names of the people that said, yes, they will help him. Singers. And that was David Bowie, Robert Plant, and Elton John. They were originally supposed to be on the album.
Gosh, that would have been quite a quite a thing to get those people together.
Would have been amazing, but all of them had obligations for touring and or recording their own albums. So so he wound up getting Ozzy Osbourne and Justin Hayward and others, Trevor Rabin. And so I called my contact at EMI, which was Dwight DeRuyter. I told him, I'm sorry to say to you, the cast of Elton and Bowie and Robert Plant are not available. And that was a little bit devastating. But he said to me, that's all right. We'll still do it. He's got Ozzy. I mean, Ozzy was very big back in those days.
Still,
But it was still disappointing to not have Elton and Bowie. But the plan went through, and what they wanted from me was a fax of an outline of what Rick's plans were with the entire cast that were confirmed. So I sent the fax and the outline, and I got the call from Rick saying that he has the go-ahead from EMI. So now people from EMI wanted to meet with Rick on the plans for Return. And that's what happened. And it went straight forward. Even the illness that Rick had really didn't delay the release of the album. So, in fact, if I recall correctly, when he began to get well in the hospital, he checked himself out of the hospital so he could do the promotional photography that you see in in the album cover.
I've got the album cover here. So he appears to be in some kind of a cave. Was that actually superimposed, or did he actually go there?
It was an actual cave.
That's really
The center of. He was going to the center of the earth.
Yes, indeed. That's wonderful. What did you think of the original record? And then what did you think of this record when you heard it for the first time?
Well, the original was incredible. I'd never heard anything like that because I had actually only been a fan of Yes for maybe 1 year at that time. When the original Journey came out. And then I saw the concert in San Francisco, and it was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that. I was only 16 years old at the time. Then doing Return, I think Rick's composition was even much better. I actually thought that the album would help Rick become a household name in America. Didn't turn out that way because I think there was somebody let a good opportunity fall through the cracks. I don't want to mention a name, but... there was supposed to be a single of Buried Alive with Ozzy. And it was a single in Sweden, but it was supposed to be worldwide. Ozzy wanted it to be worldwide, but unfortunately, the person who was in charge of that did not do everything he should do to make it happen around the world. You know, you would have to get the sign off from the various subsidiaries or the record labels to sign off in the various countries to release it as a single, because Ozzy needed to have
clearance from his own record label to do that.
That's right, and it just wasn't done properly. And so, I mean, we got down to an idea of getting Ozzy to do a video for it, but since the single wasn't being released worldwide, no point in doing a video. So my idea was to have an orchestra with Ozzy, which it's never been done, I don't think. Ozzy fronting an orchestra. Everybody would be biting the bats' heads off. No, I'm just kidding.
Nice. I'm impressed, Nick.
Yeah.
Those are great lyrics on Buried Alive. I think it would have been a good hit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great song, and I love what Ozzy does on that song. Now,
yeah.
There were concerts, weren't there, in Canada, live concerts of this recorded album? Yeah.
Yes, I think there was one, and I believe it's released in the box set that just came out.
Yeah.
But what's strange is the concert in Canada included John Anderson.
Ah, did it?
I forgot the song that John sang on the concert.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to know. I forget. But but for some reason, it's not on the CD that was released in the box set.
Oh, right. Well, tell us a bit more about that box set. It's just very recently been released, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's full of a lot of bits of CDs and with edits and stuff like that, which doesn't interest me too much, but the overall packaging is incredible. Mm-hmm. The posters and promotional items that you get on the inside of the box is amazing. Mm-hmm. They're very heavy. You get the promotional video of Rick doing the photo shoot of him in a cave.
Yeah, right.
Nice.
And you get the video of the night that the album was launched. I wish I was able to see all that, but now I can because of the video in the box set. I've never seen that before.
Yeah. So, big question for you, Nick. How would you sum up Rick's importance to the world of prog rock in general?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of people that are very important to prog rock in the world. Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins, but Yes has very important people themselves, like Chris Squire certainly was, mm-hmm. John Anderson, but nobody as big as Rick on keyboards. Mm. I get into that debate all the time with people. You know, it's the debate goes back and forth between Rick versus Keith Emerson, usually.
Yeah.
And other names don't often come up. You know, like Tony Banks is one of my favorite, but does not compare to the virtuosity of Rick Wakeman. Mm. Keith Emerson, of course, was great on his organ, but so is Rick. Different styles altogether. Mm. But nobody played the amount of multi-keyboards like Rick did, especially in the 70s. He might have been the first person to invent, or one of the first to invent, playing different keyboards at the same time with arms stretched wide.
Yeah, yes.
Mm-hmm. So he's definitely a legend, and people actually realize that now. Yeah. I mean, I think Rick has been a legendary status for years.
Yes. And what impresses me about Rick is that he does seem to, and one of my favorite albums of recent years is The Red Planet that he put together, and he seems to be just as proficient now on those Moog solos and with his piano works, and as you mentioned before, the solo piano concerts are fantastic. It's amazing that he's gone through so much, but yet he's still able to produce some wonderful music.
It is amazing, especially amazing because he has arthritis in his hands.
God, it's just incredible. Oh. Really is.
Yeah, and The Red Planet is a great accomplishment for Rick. I believe it went in the charts in the UK. Is that correct?
Yeah, it did.
It did.
We spoke to Lee Pomeroy, who played bass on it. He's a great guy as well, and he loved playing on it. And, you know, I think it's a really important work to have from Rick.
It is.
Listen, Nick, we will have you back on because I'm sure we have many more things to ask you about in the future.
Yes.
But,
all right.
For the moment, thank you very much indeed sharing that story about some of the origins of this really, really enjoyable album. And we will see you next time, Nick.
Okay, glad to talk to you guys. Take care.
Thanks very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
What about my own thoughts about this album? The first track is entitled A Vision, and it's 2 minutes and 34 seconds long. Harp and strings complement flute and clarinet solos, and it feels like a cinematic opening in an authentic Hollywood style. Trevor Rabin, who appears later, would be rather pleased with this effect in one of his own soundtracks, I imagine. The choir enters, singing "The Centre of the Earth" repeatedly. Patrick Stewart appears, steeped in reverb, I suppose to evoke a cave setting. His narration is superb, of course. His voice is just like treacle, wonderfully complex and deep. The story is also not that bad at all. It doesn't grate. It sounds absolutely fine to me, and it's a very hopeful opening indeed. Track two is the Return Overture, which is again about 2.5 minutes long. So here we expect to have versions of the thematic musical content of the whole work laid out for us. Ah, we have drums. And a slightly silly tune. It's not too bad, but remove the drums and I'd be a lot happier. The chorus reappears with that refrain from the first song, and I can't help smiling. It's a tiny bit cheesy. The orchestral arrangement is good, as is the choral writing, but the overall effect is melodramatic, to say the least. Everything improves dramatically, though, when Rick enters with a sparkling mini-moog solo, and I realise I'm going to have to come to terms with the general style of this piece. It is sure to remain similar throughout, so I'll try and listen to it on its own terms. The trouble I think I always have with this kind of music is that I've been involved in some pretty large-scale classical concerts with choir, orchestra and the kitchen sink, so I naturally compare this with that, which isn't helpful at all. After all, this isn't meant to be Mahler's Eighth Symphony, Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, or even Carmina Burana, by the perhaps aptly named Karl Orff. Sounds a bit like an English accent command, I always think. Incidentally, if you haven't heard those works, and you like Wakeman's epics, I highly recommend listening to them to see from whence Rick's music derives at least some of its source material. Anyway, back to our return journey. The next track is Mother Earth. A, the Shadow of June, B, the Gallery, C, the Avenue of Prismed Light, D, the Earthquake. Interesting to see Rick borrowing from the Yes tradition of named segments. Or maybe it's actually the tradition Yes borrowed from elsewhere. So we have 3 minutes, 48 seconds to paint an oral picture of those four elements of the quest. There's more wonderful narration and very effective wordless choral accompaniment. I really like the orchestral arrangement as well, as it complements the script wonderfully well. Solo oboe and flute with lush strings and nimble melodies effectively describe the story. I'm also enjoying the narrative, which feels authentic and not contrived. Just before the end of the track, an earthquake begins and the music grows in intensity to match. We find ourselves at Buried Alive, which is the first actual song. It features Ozzy Osbourne on lead vocals and a backing chorus, along with full orchestral and band accompaniment. I've actually always liked Ozzy Osbourne's voice, which is as characterful and recognisable as John Anderson's, but clearly rather different, and this is a fun song. It has a groovy string and bass riff and is very catchy, especially the sing-along chorus. Fast strings whiz up and down in a new section, and this is perhaps the best Wakeman song I've heard. It's dramatic, but not in a cheesy way. The guitar solo echoes the blisteringly fast strings, and Rick throws in a synth solo for good measure. Surprisingly good stuff with a rock and roll ending, featuring the band which then fades out. The Enigma is next. A short bridging passage with more gorgeous narration. It's impossible not to compare this work with Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds, and so far it's just as enjoyable for me. This narration in particular is reminiscent of Richard Burton's in that H.G. Wells adaptation. Is Anybody There is the next fairly obviously named track. Bonnie Tyler gets to add her voice this time. The introduction is intriguing and Tyler's voice is perfect to convey the sense of unease in the lyrics. It's slow-paced and quite like a stage musical number. Backing choir adds to the effect and the orchestral arrangement is great. What no one else can match in their epics is the fabulous mini-moog solo, of course, and it's integrated nicely here. Tyler's delivery gets even more throaty, gritty, and impassioned as she continues, a very enjoyable song. Brian May Guitar Orchestra is a tasty addition, and this is contrasted superbly with sections of solo oboe and then a large-scale full ensemble ending. So far, there haven't been really any King Arthur-esque daft moments, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed. Next, we come to the Ravine, another short bridging section, with narration as the travellers continue their journey. Patrick Stewart introduces the next track, The Dance of a Thousand Lights, which he tells us are created by fireflies. This starts with string-led orchestral playfulness, but then Rick appears with a sparkling and fleet-of-finger piano solo, which describes the lights in a fun manner. If you remember the theme tune to the 1970s British TV show All Creatures Great and Small, then you'll get the idea of this Wakeman piece. It's a bit more of a symphonic romp than that theme, but shares some of the character with the piano leading the way. Once again, it's great fun. It could indeed be a TV theme or incidental music. Rick ramps up the speed for a dash to the end, which then subsides a little before a slightly comic strings workout, which almost throws us off, but Rick's piano rescues the day with a neat ending. The Shepherd is a slightly baffling title, but it's another narration passage in which we are told all about the next portion of an amazingly lush subterranean landscape. It turns out prehistoric animals are being looked after by a human-like blind shepherd. So there you go. Mr. Slow is the next track, which has Tony Mitchell as well as a synthetic drum track, which is a little bit distracting. But when the vocals begin, it's possible to ignore it. So Mr. Slow is the shepherd, it seems, and he appears to be fairly content with his cavern-dwelling situation, although he would rather be able to see, which seems a bit of a puzzle, as I can't work out how he knows other people can see if he's been in literally the dark all his life. Anyway, it's a decent song and a great performance from Mitchell. Bridge of Time comes next, in which a synth and harp backdrop provides a bed for Stuart again. The journeyers career out of control down passages to the accompaniment of insistent brass, and suddenly we reach Never Is a Long, Long Time, with Trevor Rabin wielding his guitar and his voice. Another huge riff is taken initially by orchestra, doubled by bass, and then Rabin storms in with some powerful and exciting vocals. It's dramatic stuff, especially when the massed chorus joins in. There's a change to a major key, which works well, and the choir add a bit of an Ode to Joy authentic feel. More of a rock feel returns, and Rabin breaks out the first of his electric solos, which is short, but frenetic. So far, it's very much the Rabin lead vocals show, and that's no problem, but I'm wondering how much guitar we will be getting. This orchestration proves just how talented Rick Wakeman is at this kind of thing. Given a different career path, he could easily have rivaled Rabin in producing certain types of film soundtracks. Finally, shortly before the end of the song, Rabin appears in full Guitar Hero mode with a sumptuous solo, which growls and soars in all the right places. Wonderful, virtuosic stuff. Would I have preferred more of his guitar? Yes, of course. More narration in three parts now. Tales from the Lindenbrook pushes the story onwards. River of Hope, Hunter and Hunted, and Fight for Life describe a vast underground sea with the remnants of more prehistoric life, alongside living, anachronistic sea and air creatures. The narration describes a battle of these creatures, and the wordless chorus evokes the incidental music of 1940s epic cinema, perhaps appropriately. The strings writing is stunning and beautifully performed as we move towards the next track, The Kill. This has a jaunty rhythm and a trumpet solo. It's an interesting mix, but maybe not the most effective music of the collection so far. Drums appear after a time, and Wakeman's synth solo, which is of course magnificent. At halfway through the running order, if not the time of the album, this feels like a bit of a spacing piece, and I suppose that's fine. I'm eager to get on with the story, however. There's a nice creative time signature, and the trumpet is beautifully played, but I do feel it's a little overlong. Choir adds a bit of a Carmina Burana flavour, as I mentioned earlier, and we are treated to more sumptuous Rick soloing, so it's certainly not all bad news. Timeless History finally begins. Undulating harp and percussion accompany Patrick Stewart's continuation of the story as the travellers cross the sea. Still Waters Run Deep is Justin Hayward's chance to shine. With a bit more of a Shirley Bassey, James Bond theme vibe, it's pleasant enough, if a bit too MOR for me. There's not a great deal more to say. Very accomplished orchestration and a fine synth solo or two, but overall a bit too inoffensive for my liking. Time Within Time has two sections, A, the ebbing tide, and B, the electric storm. Some pleasant brass introduces more narration this time, about the travellers falling asleep and then being awakened by a gigantic storm. Once again, rather like a movie soundtrack, the accompaniment helps the action speed along. Katrina Laskanich is lead vocalist in Ride of Your Life, and she shows off her rock and roll credentials. There's more than a touch of Jesus Christ Superstar at times, but it's accomplished writing and just manages to stay on the acceptable side of unintended comedy, despite some perhaps overzealous orchestration and chorus work. The lyrics don't stand a lot of analysis, but that's not the point. Flashing strings and snare drumming give an exciting feel to a middle section, but unfortunately the Rick synth solo is one of his slightly silly ones. It's not too bad though, and we are soon back on track with a good rock musical romp. I can imagine just how much fun it must have been to be part of a live performance of this piece. Floating, A, Globes of Fire, B, Cascades of Fear, is next as we are told the travellers are approaching the end of their journey. To be frank, I can't really follow the story very well, but maybe I would on additional listening. There's something about being attacked by globes of fire, which presumably leads to those cascades of fear, or something like that. Anyway, Flood Flames, the next track, sees us back to rock band and strings, with some familiar riffing and a heavy groove reinforced by wordless chorus. Rick enters with another solo along the same lines as the previous one, which develops into a ferociously fast pace and is then replaced by the epic Mini Moog. I much prefer that. It's fabulous once again. The band and orchestra are enjoying themselves, and we suddenly find ourselves at the penultimate track, The Volcano, A, Tongues of Fire, B, The Blue Mountains. The characters are shooting upwards inside an active volcano shaft. Somehow they then find themselves floating with the appropriate musical accompaniment. It seems they had been shot out of a Mount Etna and were incredibly unharmed. The last piece is the end of the return, and it does indeed return to the opening material, with great characteristic orchestral and choral writing and arranging. The lyrics may be a bit daft, but the addition of yet another brilliant Rick Minimoog solo is more than enough compensation. I think if you start listening at this point, you might be slightly overcome with the excess of forces and epic approach, but in the context of the whole work, it's an effective end in the aural equivalent of glorious Technicolor and expansive Panavision widescreen action. So overall, I'm delighted to say I'm very pleasantly surprised by this album. I like it a lot more than King Arthur, and I would actually like to listen to this one again, perhaps in conjunction with the original work.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be doing part two of our look at Rick Wakeman and the return to the center of the earth. This is, of course, part of our What Did They Do Next series, which I believe this is part 20B, if you can believe that. So, return to the center of the earth. So, as we talked about last week, Rick did a album called Journey to the Center of the Earth back in 1974. I did say it was a classic. I still stand by that comment. It is a classic album in every way possible. And I did also say that making a sequel or a next part never usually goes well. But in this circumstance, I think I'm incorrect. Believe it or not, I think that this album is actually far superior to the original. Now, I haven't listened to this record for quite a while, even though I do have it. But to go and to re-listen to this once again after such a long while of not hearing it really opened my eyes and ears quite a bit. What is the thing that makes this much superior to the original? Well, there's quite a few things, but let's start off with a few little, you know, details. The album was released March 15th, 1999. It was released on EMI Classics and was produced by Rick Wakeman. They used quite a few recording studios for this, three of note are A&M, CTS Studios in London, and the Jacaranda Room. Now, that name might be familiar because that's Trevor Rabin's recording studio. The album reached number 34 on the UK album charts, which sounds like it's a pretty good ranking. EMI Classics had set a goal of selling 300,000 copies of this album. They only ended up selling 195,000 copies after 2 years. Now, that's pretty respectable considering that this is viewed as a classical record. And apparently, they did well in all the markets that they targeted. They did what they expected, except for one, and that was in the United States. They only sold 25,000 copies of this record, much to Rick's dismay. I think that he was really hoping to do better in the US, as some of his older albums really did well in that market, and I think Journey did very well in that market as well. Let's get to the music. What makes this album better? Well, there's one thing right away that I noticed. The story is very well written, very well thought out, and having Patrick Stewart doing the narration was a stroke of brilliance. Not only does he have a good voice for doing this, but I found the story very easy to follow. Now, of course, like I said before, Journey, the first album, was sort of done, you know, very unplanned, I would say, considering that they did it in a live capacity. Anything could have happened. And the narration on that record is sometimes difficult to follow. It's sometimes difficult to hear. It sounds very much like somebody was recording up in the, like, you know, 113th row in the back kind of thing. It didn't have the clarity, and therefore it was difficult to follow sometimes. This being a proper recording studio version of the record, it was recorded well, and you could follow along very easily. Now, another thing in regards to the narration, on the original version of the album, I mean on the first one, Journey, it was just narration. He was speaking, telling the story, and that's fine, and that was actually probably good, because on this album, Rick made unique music to each narration part. So if you think about that, he wrote all the music for the songs, the instrumentals, and even the vocal ones, but he also wrote music for each narration section. So that's a lot of music. The ones of note are The Shepherd, The Ravine, and Bridge of Time. Those were really interesting bits of music that he wrote underneath the narration. And I think that also adds a lot to it. You know, having the music with the narration, it adds a good flow to it. Now, the songs themselves, there's quite a few of them, and they're really, really well done. Now, one of the other key factors I think that makes this album superior over Journey is that this one sounds more like a movie soundtrack, very much more modernized, whereas Journey sounds more like an actual orchestra performance. Doesn't have as much of a soundtrack feel to it. And like I said before, this is something that happened in the moment. So maybe at the time when Journey was being done, that's what he was striving for, a true sort of orchestra album. Whereas at this point, he maybe saw, you know, visions of a movie behind it, or who knows what he could have thought of, but it definitely has more of a movie soundtrack feel to it. And I think that really worked out well. Now, some of the song highlights from this album, honestly, I think Buried Alive with Ozzy singing was really, really well done. Now, here's an example of somebody who, when you first look at the lineup of people who appeared on this, people would have probably thought Ozzy in an orchestra sort of setting. I don't think that'll work, but believe it or not, I think it worked really well. He sang really well. The music behind it fit really well. And it didn't sound like he felt out of place singing the song whatsoever. One thing I would love to have found out is, how did they actually record Ozzy's part? Did they actually do a sort of band recording of it with drums, guitars, bass, and they had him sing it, and then they put everything else around it? Or did they actually give him a full version of it with the orchestra and everything? I'm very curious about that, because if he sang it with the orchestra like that, then I'm very impressed, because I don't know how he would do in that setting, like I said before. So hats off to Ozzy. Good job. The overture, as I mentioned last week, Rick is always very good at writing these sort of overture parts. This part in particular was very well done. There's some great choir parts in there. There's actually, the choir on this is very well done, much better than on Journey. Very well constructed. They appear in parts where I think they fit really well, and sometimes they're not in other parts, and I think where they're placed on this album is really well thought out. A lot of great percussion on this, lots of bell trees and sort of chimes and stuff like that, and it's a lot more noticeable obviously in this studio setting than in the live version. So I really like these sorts of percussion bits. And of course in the overture you have these signature sort of mini Moog solo parts that Rick is so good at doing. That's very evident in this as well. Now, the other songs of note, I'm not going to go through all of them because I'll be here for like 45 minutes if I did that. But the other songs of note are Is Anybody There with Bonnie Tyler. Great vocal performance. She has that really lush sort of female voice. And then once again, a lot of choir parts in there almost kind of supporting her, and very strong. They work very well together, and a lot of very good epic sounding orchestra parts. Another song that I had forgotten all about that I really enjoyed is The Dance of a Thousand Lights. That's a Rick Wakeman piano showpiece, hands down. Excellent playing by Rick on piano, and the orchestra is really good on this one. It's very easy for an orchestra to overwhelm a single instrument like a piano or a violin, like a solo violin. But in this situation, I think they constructed it and wrote it very well so that the orchestra parts were very evident, but not stomping all over his piano work. Great, great piano playing by Rick on this. And there's just two more I'm going to talk about. The Kill, which is an instrumental piece, is very well done. The whole mood of the song is very well constructed. It just fits that whole part of the story very, very well. I'm not going to talk about the story because I don't want to give it away. I'm very sure that there'll be people who'll be interested in picking up this album and listening to it, so I'm not going to give away any of the story here. But let's just say for this part of the story, the instrumentation and the whole orchestra parts for it are very, very well done, a standout part. And the last song I'm going to talk about is Never Is a Long, Long Time. Now, this is a song that Trevor Rabin sings on, and this is the only song that I have a little bit of trouble with, only because I find that
while it's a good performance, I don't think it's anywhere near his best vocal performance. He's done much better ones, I've found, not only on Yes albums, but on his solo work as well. I kind of get the feeling that he feels a little out of place. This is not really an environment I can imagine him being in very often. I mean, he does tons of soundtracks, obviously. But I can't imagine that he ever thought that he would be a singer in an orchestra sort of situation. And it kind of shows. I think he did it more to, you know, to help out Rick. I'm guessing Rick asked him to do it. I couldn't imagine him saying, hey, Rick, can I come on your orchestra album and sing here? I'm not saying that's a bad performance. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to get tomatoed to death here. But I think that, if anything, he's the one who sounds uncomfortable a bit in this environment, whereas people would have thought Ozzy was. Ozzy sounds fine in this situation. It's funny that I think Trevor is the one who ends up sounding not too comfortable in this song. But like I said, don't get me wrong, the song is very good, and it's an important part of the story as well. I'll just leave that in there as well. Not a big fan of this song, but it's important to the story, and he does do a good performance. It's just not something that I thought he did as well as he could have. So overall, I think this record is almost a 5-star, in my opinion. It is definitely better than Journey, but I'll be ready to admit that I don't think this album will get the same sort of recognition 20 years down the road as Journey has. I think Journey has been firmly etched in musical history as a important record, and I don't think this one will get the same attention, but that's a shame because I do think it's a much, much better record. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about this further.
So I'm here with Mark now, and it was great to speak to Nick earlier, but hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. What about yourself?
Pretty good. A little bit of rain here the last couple of days, but good weather to continue mixing a record to.
Oh, yes. Very exciting. Okay. Right, so Return to the Center of the Earth. And, you know, I was really surprised. I was so pleasantly surprised. I really enjoyed this. And I did, after I'd listened to this record, because I've not listened to the original at all, I went back and just sort of skipped through it very quickly. I'll need to go back and listen to it. And I think a lot of the things you were saying are absolutely right. Because this is a studio version, that makes a big difference, doesn't it? I mean, the sound quality is fantastic, but I didn't think the sound quality on the original was too bad either.
No, I mean, look, I'm not trying to make it sound like it's such a huge radical difference from the original. I mean, like I said, it was good enough that Mo-Fi made a pressing of it, and that pressing is outstanding, as I said in my piece, too. But, you know, there's obviously going to be a difference between the quality that you can achieve in a studio when you can, you know, if you do something incorrectly, you can stop and go back. But you can't just go, excuse me, everybody, all 15,000 here. We're going to start that piece again. The seventh violin did something incorrect there. So, yeah.
Yes, indeed. So you've got to go with warts and all, haven't you, when you're doing a live recording, of course. So, yes, why didn't anyone buy it in the US?
That's a very, very good question, because like we mentioned during our interview with Nick, Ozzy was a big name, you know, and you would figure by this point that Ozzy Osbourne maybe in itself would have maybe helped boost the sales. It'd be sad to think that the 25,000 that they sold was because of Ozzy. I really doubt that. You know, I'm just guessing it could be just bad timing. I mean, we were coming out of the grunge thing. The grunge thing ended around, I'd say, 96, 97. And I think at this point, the music industry was kind of floundering at what direction it was going to take next. You know, you come out of such a huge scene as the grunge thing, and then it started getting into like a little bit of garage rock and a little bit of like all over the place, like a little bit of singer-songwriter, a little bit of the boy band thing. So, the direction was not really there, and it's not like Rick ever was in step with direction ever. but I mean, you know, and this is, and I kind of wonder now after we did this interview with Nick, whether or not the people that were supposed to be on this record maybe would have substantially boosted sales for this album.
Absolutely, they would have done. But I think you're right. Perhaps it wasn't brilliant timing to produce an epic in this, you know, of this scale. People in America maybe weren't interested in buying something like this, and it was, you know, it was very out of the ordinary in terms of what the man in the street, woman in the street was buying at the time. So perhaps that was it. But I think it's a really good quality. piece of music.
Yeah, and I mean, the one other thing that I kind of wanted to mention, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, was that I found it interesting that while EMI Classics stepped up to do the record for him, and I thought that was fantastic that they would do that for him, I also wonder if that might have been a little bit of an error as well, because EMI Classics very much markets their stuff to a certain, you know, demographic of the music culture, which are classical music people, right? And I'm sure if they go and, you know, put a big advert in all the classic magazines or the places where they would normally advertise, you know, saying new Rick Wakeman album coming out, I'm sure, you know, the chaps that usually buy these records, you know, sitting there under chairs going, who's this Rick Wakeman bloke? You know, like maybe they would not know who it is because they're expecting the latest Beethoven reissue or something, you know, and like Rick Wakeman, whereas EMI, the normal label, might have had a much different approach in promoting it.
I think you're right. The fact that it had that, you know, I've got the CD here and it very clearly says, it doesn't say on the front actually, but very clearly on the back it says EMI Classics, and you wouldn't be looking for this kind of music if you were a classic fan. Maybe. Perhaps I'm completely wrong about that. Maybe you would enjoy it very much, as I have done, but maybe not. However, and it's a shame, obviously, that they couldn't get those original people, Elton John and Robert Plant, wasn't it, and David Bowie, on there. Clearly that would have, as you say, boosted the visibility of the album, if nothing else. But what they have got is great, and obviously, the Patrick Stewart narration, I thought it was going to be good, but it's absolutely brilliant, isn't it? And I think Rick's text that he came up with for the narration is actually rather good. And it does capture quite a bit of the feel of the original book. And I think the original record had essentially edited down versions of what was actually the text of the book. But this does seem to carry on in the same sort of vein, doesn't it? And certainly his vocal performance, Patrick Stewart, is wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I really enjoyed. I mean, I listened to the record a couple of times, just, you know, in my cave there, and then I went and listened to it a couple of times on headphones, and just hearing him doing his narration, I mean, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so to me it was like very comforting to sit there and hear, you know, Captain Picard narrating, you know, Return to the Center of the Earth, you know, so it for me it was absolutely fantastic. I mean, I am curious to hear our listeners to see if there's any non-Star Trek fans here and to hear their opinion of how he narrated, because I think overall, you got to remember, this guy was a guy who's done many Shakespeare plays and stuff. Yes. So it's not like he's like, you know, only done sci-fi stuff. He's done many things that are of note, and you can tell in his delivery that he's very well, you know, well read, and he knows how to do these sorts of things.
Absolutely right. And it's such a wonderful voice he has for exactly this kind of thing. Now, I couldn't, as I said in my piece, I couldn't help comparing this to War of the Worlds. Is War of the Worlds a record that you know very well?
Honestly, I must hang my head in shame. I know I do it to you sometimes when I say, what, Kevin, you don't know this record? Like, but I don't know this album at all.
Well, you must listen to War of the Worlds because it does have some pretty similar features to Return and... you know, it has narration in the same way. It has that sort of big English voice narrating it. I think it's Richard Burton, I think, who does the original one. And it was a big hit, certainly over this side of the Atlantic. And in recent years, they did an awful sort of popped up version, which I hated, with synthetic drums and things. But they have done some concerts recently of War of the Worlds. And it's really fantastic. And it's got, in the same way, guest vocalists throughout it, and a big orchestra and a rock band and so on. So it is quite similar in some ways. And I bet that if you like War of the Worlds, you're bound to like this record. And I think it stands up very well to that War of the Worlds record. And so this movie soundtrack idea, that I agree with you entirely. This sounds very cinematic, doesn't it? And I was just thinking that at this point where Trevor Rabin was just getting going in his cinema soundtrack production work, he must have really enjoyed being part of this because it has that cinematic feel, and perhaps he learned a few things.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because I kind of wondered how much involvement Trevor might have had, you know, quietly behind the scenes, because, you know, he was getting into it at this point. You know, maybe he did, you know, give each other pointers in it, because it, like I said, it's definitely much more cinematic in its approach, the delivery of it. I mean, the way they split up the chapters, and I really love the way that he put all these like unique pieces of music underneath the narration, because when he did the original, you know, they did the, you know, the music and they did the stop, and all of a sudden the narrator would come out, blah, 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 right? And there was no music under it.
Yes,
you know?
I did notice that even in my little brief listen, yes.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's another big advantage to it, because that kind of feel that he can put underneath the speaking really helps project that whole, you know, chapter that is to come.
Yeah, and I was comparing this as well to Deep Purple's Concerto for Band and Orchestra. Is that, or for group and orchestra, sorry. Is that a record you've heard?
This is another hang my head in shame.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I was particularly excited to find this back in the 80s when I got a vinyl copy of it, because clearly it blended again in the same way, a rock band with an orchestra. But in the same way as I think maybe more in the original Journey record, a lot of it is either orchestra or band, and they don't blend them in quite the way that Rick has done here. And that's one of the things I enjoyed most about this. Sometimes Rick's orchestral work really annoys me because I find that the drums don't fit. But this time I wasn't put off half as much as I thought I would be by the drums and the band. I think he's blended the two really rather well on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the advantages of doing a part two or a sequel or a, you know, a redo is that you can kind of correct the things that you didn't like about the previous version. And I think this was something that he definitely had in mind, is to put the sort of rock ensemble element of this, you know, more in fitting with the orchestra. Because I think now everything was much more thought out, everything was much more arranged, and they had the beauty of having the studio that where they can run through it and say, okay, I think that, you know, Simon is a little too busy on the drums in this song, maybe back it down a bit, or, you know, this section needs more tom fills. You know, he can really map it out better using the studio, whereas live, I was like, whatever happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think the songs, as it were, the actual songs, I didn't really realise that Rick Wakeman could write really good melodies and really good vocal lines for
this. That's great.
I mean, particularly the Ozzy Osbourne one, Buried Alive, but also Never Is a Long, Long Time, the Rabin one. I wasn't as keen on the Justin Hayward one. It turned a bit MOR for me, frankly. And Ride of Your Life, I think, is good as well. But particularly the first two, the Ozzy Osbourne and the Tony Mitchell. Oh, that's another one, isn't it? The Mr. Slow. But certainly the Never Is a Long, Long Time. Really good songs, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think, though, and I'm not sure if you agree with this, this will be an excellent point to bring up now. I really felt that Trevor sounded a little uncomfortable to me. I think in this situation, he doesn't, he was so, I don't know if I'm going to say he's used to, but he seems, his element is much more like that kind of, you know, rock music, you know, like I always said, like his Can't Look Back, that record that he did, that solo record. He's that's like what I envision him at his most comfortable, making music like that, you know. But when he is in this situation, I think it's a little, I don't know, I think it almost sounded like he felt a little unnerved, which was interesting, because I would have thought that Ozzy would have been more, you know, out of place doing it with an orchestra, but he did a fantastic job on this song. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Never Is a Long, Long Time is a bad song. It's an excellent song and a very important part of the story.
Yeah.
But I think that in comparison, I think Ozzy did a slightly better job than I think Trevor did in this situation, which is interesting because he's so wanting to get involved with, you know, cinema soundtrack stuff, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I understand what you're saying. It didn't leap out at me, Trevor Rabin's discomfort or anything, but I can see exactly what you mean. And definitely in terms of the vocals, Ozzy is very much the star, and it would have been great, wouldn't it, to have that single idea that Nick
talked about, and that could have done great things for the album as well. But yes, it's fantastic to have this second part. And as you were saying, actually, a really good return to to another album that you've made in the past, and a really worthwhile thing, because as you say, you can really work on the idea and produce something that you really wanted to in the first place. It's just a shame that it wasn't quite as successful as they hoped it would be, for whatever reason. But I'm really glad that we've managed to discover this and listen to it, because you know, there are certain things about it. For example, I could have done with even more of that piano, because I think that's the Dance of a Thousand Lights. I think the piano, as you said, is just stunning in that. So more of that would have been even better. And I could have done with a little bit more of Rabin's guitar. It'd be fascinating to find out exactly what he did in terms of the recording of it. As you said, the Jacaranda Room, which is his recording studio, is mentioned there. So was that just him recording his vocal and guitar parts on its own, or did he have more input? So perhaps we ought to ask our friend from the Rabin-esque blog to to find out for us exactly what Trevor Rabin did on this album. That would be fascinating. But yeah, overall, I was really pleasantly surprised. And as I said in my piece, it's an album that I will listen to again. I'm not sure whether I will how many more times I will listen to King Arthur, which I found quite difficult to get through in places. But this was a really enjoyable experience.
Yeah, this is really a fantastic album. And like I said, I really think that this is an example of a record that, you know, is not an error in judgment. This is a great record. And, you know, it's funny that you brought up King Arthur, because much like this record, he did do a sort of revamp of King Arthur in the 2000s as well. Mm. Very similar. He went into the studio and did a whole new thing with a whole bunch of symphony orchestra and choir. And I have that on vinyl, and it is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant stuff. So I really am discovering some aspects of Rick Wakeman's output that I didn't know existed and that I've really enjoyed. So not only things like The Red Planet, where he obviously is deliberately trying to do progressive rock sounding rock band type albums, this I really enjoyed as well. So perhaps I ought to delve a little further into Rick Wakeman's output and not be so dismissive as I have perhaps been in the past. But anyway, have your say on this. Leave your comments on the show notes for this week's episode. What do you think of this record? Have you enjoyed it as much as I have discovering it these couple of weeks? So thanks very much indeed for the moment, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.